cups, and, well, the list just went on and on.
Will it hurt?
Daniel asked the dentist.
Only a little pinch at the start to make your gum numb, but nothing that will trouble a tough guy like you.
The dentist had lied. The injection really stung, and Daniel was embarrassed to feel tears squeeze from his eyes. On the way home, Grandpa Owen described it as a life lesson.
If someone tells you something's not gonna hurt, it's gonna hurt. If they tell you it's gonna hurt a little, it's gonna hurt a lot. The only time they're not lying is if they just tell you straight out that it's gonna hurt.
None of which made Daniel feel any better about the world. Now, with his mouth beginning to return to normality, he reckoned he could handle a big glass of Coke without depositing half of it over his chin and clothes. Except Grandpa Owen had poured all the soda down the sink and taken an inventory of the candy supply before jamming most of it into the pockets of his coat, leaving only a couple of bars on the highest closet shelf, the one Daniel couldn't reach even with the aid of a chair. This, Daniel decided, was a sucky day. Grandpa Owen was snoozing in the armchair beside him. Grandpa Owen didn't like kids' cartoons any more than Grandpa Owen liked candy. And while Daniel could usually consume both with equal gusto, the images on the TV were irritating him today. Maybe he'd go play a game instead. He was just getting to his feet when the toy telephone began to ring. Chapter 34. They weren't the first such images Parker had viewed, and he did not believe they would be the last. But they subsequently stayed with him in a way that others had not, and it took him a while to understand why. Gray. A body embryonic huddled in an earthen womb, sacking in a bedsheet for its amniotic membrane. The left hand drawn up to the mouth, as though to stifle some final cry. The knees to the chest, the right arm mostly concealed beneath the body, except for the fingers, outstretched and visible at the hip. Hair, what remained of it, long. Some skin yet adhering to the skull. The decay would have been more profound had she been interred in warmer weather, but a cold ground burial had preserved her. Still recognizably a woman, the elements of a human being discarded. But no, not quite a discarding. This was not simply a disposal of a thing unwanted, or a repudiation of criminal evidence. The inhumation feels, if not reverent, then duteous. Some care has been taken here, or perhaps his perception has been influenced by the marker, a stellate testament to the presence of the dead, a sign to commemorate but not invite discovery. To have spent so long out here, alone, waiting. Were you sought? Did someone fear for you? Even now, is there a father, a mother, a sibling hoping for your return? If you are not to be restored alive to these others, they have a right to know of your passing, so that misplaced hope or fears of some ongoing torment of mind or flesh may be brought to a close. Who put you here in this dark wood? Was it a husband? A stranger? Did you suffer? If so, I am sorry. If I could, I would have saved you from it. Why did you die? How did you die? Who are you? We will try to put a name to you. You have spent too long unacknowledged. And we will find your child. It would require darkness for Parker to start to comprehend, and sleep for him to discover an answer. In his dream, he would stand over the desiccated remains of the woman, her enfolded residue, and traverse a landscape of skin and bone until he came at last to the part that was both of her and of another. A reminder that something remained lost. The peat had preserved so much. A little more acidity to the soil, a wrapping of moisture-trapping plastic instead of porous cotton, and only bones might have been left. But nature had conspired in the safeguarding of the body, and so there was skin, hair, and fingernails. And something more. A tendril of tissue, with a withered oval of flesh at the end. The placenta and the umbilical cord. This was not alone a woman. This was a mother. But that was all to come. For now, Parker stood with Alan and took in the photographs and video images contained in a file on the lawman's computer. Alan had offered to call in one of the evidence technicians to go through the information, but Parker didn't want to distract them from their work, and he was also pretty sure that Alan knew as much as anyone about the investigation. He would stay in touch with Walsh for the rest. Parker was always astonished at how fast crime scene technology progressed. In addition to the pictures and video images, a series of 360-degree scans of the gravesite and its surroundings were available to view, so that at any point an officer could place him or herself at the center of the scene. Alan told Parker that the MSP would soon be using drones for mapping, although up here their usefulness would be determined by the thickness of the canopy. Parker knew little of what he was seeing would be useful to him, but it was important to accept any information offered. Finally, he reached the last of the detailed images of the body. What followed were pictures of the fallen tree and the hole left by it, both with and without the remains of the woman. Some were merely close-ups of dirt, through which Parker began scanning quickly until Alan stopped him.
"You remember earlier when I said there might be a problem?"
"What am I missing?" Parker asked. Alan appeared almost embarrassed.
"It's gonna sound weird."
"Believe me, you're preaching to the choir."
"First of all, there's no reason why that tree should have come down. It was healthy, and the ground was stable. But once it fell, it caused the additional disturbance on the slope that uncovered the remains. Then there's the way the dirt was dispersed in the aftermath, and the extent of the body revealed after the fall."
Alan began flipping back and forth between images while Parker looked on.
"It may turn up in the forensic report, because I know the anthropologists were puzzled by it."
"By what exactly?" Parker was growing impatient.
"By the fact that the body was mostly visible when it was found, but the hole made by the tree in the direction of soil shift should only have revealed the torso and nothing below the waist."
Parker considered what he was hearing. "So you're saying that someone started digging up the remains before the police were informed?"
"This land is managed by a private company called Piscataquis Root and Branch. It's a family business, and it was two of the sons who found the body. They took photos of it after they called us, just in case of further collapses. But they say they didn't touch it, and I believe them."
"If they didn't, who did?"
"We found no footprints in the dirt, and no signs of outside interference. But there was still dirt scattered beyond the grave."
"An animal?"
"Again, no tracks. And don't forget it rained that night, so the soil was damp."
Alan displayed a few more images before closing the file and putting the laptop away. "Then what's the explanation?" Parker asked.
"I don't have one."
"What if we were just talking, and this was only a story?" said Parker.
"You mean what if I could make stuff up?"
"I believe speculate sounds more professional."
"Well, if I was speculating for a story, maybe one to scare my kids when we were all sitting round a campfire, I'd tell them that the tree didn't fall, but was pushed up from below the ground. And whatever did it, then began digging itself out of the dirt. And when it was done, it curled right back up again and waited for someone to come along and find it. But that would just be a story. And this is real life."
Parker allowed some seconds to pass before extending his right hand.
Thank you for your time and your help.
He and Alan shook.
I have four kids, said Alan. Three girls and the youngest a boy. His name's Jake. He came as a surprise, the last shake of the bag. He's about to turn five. The next youngest has nearly a decade on him, and the two eldest just started college. We love them all, but my wife, she dotes on Jake. I guess she'd resigned herself to never having another child, yet there he is.
5 years old, said Parker.
5 years. The same age that child would be if it survived. Just so you understand, this wasn't simply a matter of professional courtesy.
Parker nodded.
Maybe I'll see you around. I'll be up here for the time being, said Alan. Not getting shot at.
Chapter 35. Morris followed the signs to the lighthouse at Cape Elizabeth and parked the car by a rocky outcrop created by layers of quartzite fractured to a wood-like grain, as though the beacon stood above the remains of some petrified forest. She allowed Quail to wander off alone, and alternately dozed and listened to classical music until the day began to die. Only then did she venture out after the lawyer, her coat gathered against the sharp wind from the sea. She found Quail seated on a rock below a shuttered restaurant, staring out at the breaking waves, as immobile as a church gargoyle, like a feature of the rock itself. He had been seated in the same position for so long that she thought she could perceive crystals of salt on his skin and clothing. Unlike her, he showed no sign of being troubled by the elements, and he seemed barely to breathe. Had she put her hand to his breast, she knew she would have struggled to detect the beating of a heart.
"It's time," she said.
Chapter 36.
Dr. Ken Hubble looked like the kind of physician who turned up only in nostalgic Hollywood movies and television series about angels doing good deeds. He had white hair and a long white mustache, and his office shelves were heavy with thank you cards, children's drawings, and photographs of the good doctor himself, some of them clearly dating back decades, mostly in the company of a variety of small dogs. He spoke with Parker while drinking herbal tea from a world's best grandpa mug.
"I was first on the scene after the body was found," said Hubble. "It was a damn miserable morning, I'll tell you that. I think I'm still feeling it in my bones."
He went through the initial examination with Parker and his contemporaneous notes from the site, even making copies of the paperwork he'd forwarded to the ME's office in Augusta.
"Anything out of the ordinary?" Parker asked. "Beyond a young mother in a shallow grave?"
"Beyond that."
Hubble blew on his tea.
"You were a policeman, weren't you?" he said.
"A long time ago."
"But you could still tell the difference between a body that's been dumped and one that's been laid to rest?"
"Yes."
"Well, this woman was laid to rest. I guarantee it. I'd also be surprised if the ME finds any signs of external injury."
"External?"
Hubble squinted at Parker over the rim of his spectacles.
"You need me to test your hearing for you?"
"No, I hear just fine."
"What about internal injuries?"
Hubble's eyes remained fixed on Parker.
"Such as?"
"Damage to the uterus."
"Seems like your hearing is pretty good, if you can hear all the way to R&O.
"So it's true?"
Hubble shrugged.
"It'll be out there soon enough, so no harm in me confirming what you already know. The placenta tore itself prematurely from the wall of the uterus, leading to severe hemorrhaging and death. There's not much an amateur can do for a woman who starts bleeding out in the deep woods."
"Could the child have survived?"
"Well, somebody cut that umbilical cord with a blade, so, yes, it looked like it survived the birth. Whether it lasted for long is another matter."
"A blade?"
It had not struck Parker to ask about the cutting of the cord. He was out of practice.
"And the discovery of the body?"
What about it?
I've seen the photographs. Parker paused, trying to be careful in his phrasing. I might have expected more earth on the remains.
There was some shelter from the roots of the tree, but she was still exposed to wind and rain. No, I wasn't particularly concerned by that.
It was an interesting choice of words, and Parker picked up on it. What were you concerned by? Parker asked. Hubble's fingers performed a little dance on his mug, like a pianist practicing scales.
My first impression, he said, was that the body might have been moved.
Why?
Its position didn't quite match the depression in the earth around it. The arrangement wasn't perfect.
You didn't mention that in your report.
Because I was probably mistaken.
Again, why?
If the remains had been moved, it would have resulted in serious damage. Detachment of limbs, perforation of the skin. I saw no evidence of that. The most likely explanation is some settling of the soil combined with the action of wind and rain.
But still, an iota of doubt remained, as otherwise Hubble wouldn't have mentioned the position of the body. Parker didn't pursue the subject. He had learned enough. He thanked the physician for his time and paused by the photographs on the shelves. That's a lot of dogs.
27 so far, and each is different as day from night. You have a dog?
Not any longer.
You have a family?
A daughter. She lives with her mother in Vermont.
So you live alone?
Yes.
Get a dog. Keeps you alert, keeps you active, keeps you from getting lonely.
Funny. I was just thinking about that earlier today.
Well, said Hubble, I can't call it doctor's orders, but doctor's advice. And good luck with finding the child. I'd like to think that it's out there somewhere alive. One has to hope, you know?
Yes, said Parker. I know. Chapter 37 Mela Lombardi sensed intrusion to her home as soon as she closed the front door behind her, as though all her furniture had been shifted slightly in her absence and the wattage of the bulbs reduced. A smell of pickles invaded her nostrils, and beneath it an odor that was almost male, a stink she associated with teenage boys careless in both habit and hygiene. But before she could react, a cloth had been placed over her mouth and nose, and the pickle scent overwhelmed all else. And Mela Lombardi succumbed to the dark. Chapter 38 Parker drove back to Scarborough in a silent car. He neither wanted nor needed the distraction of the radio. He desired only to think as the light faded around him and the dig was left behind. Someone local had put the woman in the ground. The route to the burial site was not one to be taken by persons unfamiliar with the terrain. For a start, it was too arduous. Trees overhung the secondary road that led to the grave, so even in daylight it would be shadowy and difficult to navigate. In addition, someone from away could not be certain that the road did not lead to a cabin or camp, or cleave through territory favored by hunters and hikers, or monitored by foresters. And there was the ground itself, soft, easy to break. Spruce roots didn't run deep, and a cursory search, combined with a little knowledge of woodland, would have enabled the person digging to find a relatively clear spot. Finally, some common sense had come into play. Even the coldest of individuals would feel concern at driving any distance with a body concealed in the trunk of a car or hidden in the bed of a truck. The aim would be to rid oneself of the remains as quickly as possible, which meant that no one unfamiliar with the land on which the body was found would have chosen it as a dumping ground. It was not just secluded, it was too secluded. No, only a local would have adjudged it appropriate for a secret burial. Then what of the child? Assuming it was not interred near the mother, and Parker was increasingly tending toward the belief, shared by Allen and Hubble, that its absence from the mother's grave offered some prospect of its survival,
then whoever dug the hole was either still in possession of the child or knew where it was. This wasn't necessarily a positive development. There were men, women too, but they were rarer, whose depravity could be fed by a baby. Either way, the mystery of the lost child was likely to be solved in the region. Someone from Piscataquis or its immediate environs knew its fate. But it was possible that some fresh information might emerge as a result of the press conference scheduled for the following day, one the local news services would be encouraged to pitch to the nationals. The infant was the hook. The body of a woman found in the woods would not be enough to draw out-of-state interest, but add a narrative in which she was not simply another Jane Doe buried in a shallow grave. And what did it say about humankind, Parker thought, that this was not considered sufficiently worthy of attention? But a new mother, one whose child was still missing, and the media would have a mystery. What did appear certain, though, was that the anonymous woman was not from Maine. The state currently had fewer than 30 ongoing missing persons cases being investigated by the Major Crimes Unit of the MSP, most of which involved males. Of the cases involving women, none fit the time frame or the age profile of the recovered body. By the time the lights of Portland appeared in the distance, Parker had put together a plan of approach, but he knew he was likely to be either one step behind or ahead of the state police in everything he did, because they would be following the same investigative processes. For once, Parker was not in competition with law enforcement, or working to protect a client whose interests might not be best served by exposure to a police investigation. Yet neither did he feel entirely comfortable taking Moxie Caston's money for a job that the police were qualified to do equally well, if not better. He called Moxie and gave him a rundown on what he had learned so far, which wasn't much at all. But Parker did share his belief that the person responsible for burying the woman was native to Piscataquis County, although it didn't necessarily mean that he or she, or the child if it still lived, remained in the area, or even the state. "Do I detect a note of unhappiness?" Moxie asked. "Call it a pang of conscience." "Over what?" "I get the feeling the police are on top of this one, which means I'm uncomfortable about taking money for walking the same ground." "You'll never make a lawyer if you start having qualms." "I'll try to hide the pain those words have caused me. Otherwise, I think we should see what comes out of tomorrow's press conference. If all the police get is an echo, we'll talk again. If we're operating on the assumption that the child is alive, I already have some thoughts on how to proceed, but it'll be time-consuming and unpleasant." Parker had made a call to Walsh on the way back to Portland. According to the detective, the investigators were probably going to wait for the completion of the search and confirmation of the presence or absence of further remains before taking the next step, which would involve a general approach to the state's medical professionals and pediatricians in particular, seeking information on any unexpected postnatal consultations corresponding to the time of Jane Doe's death. It was possible that this might produce some leads, but the end result would still be as Parker had suggested. "Because nobody wants a stranger knocking on their door and asking if their child is really blood to them," said Moxie. "That's it exactly." "I appreciate your honesty, even if it means you're going to die poor. I'm not only paying you to look into this, but also to shadow the police. Bill me for a few hours each day, at least for now. I'd prefer you to stay on top of it." "There is one other thing."
"Go on."
"I had a visit from Bobby Ocean."
"He's persistent."
"He's more than that. He seems to be of the opinion that I bear some responsibility for the destruction of his son's truck. He also referred to you as a Semite, and in a tone that leads me to suspect he may not have been serious about putting business your way. He came to you because of me. Oh, and he doesn't care much for blacks and homosexuals either, although he didn't express it in precisely those terms. He suggested I tell the Negroes and queers of my acquaintance that a new order was rising."
"The Negroes and queers of your acquaintance?" said Moxie. "Well, at least you'll only have to make one call. So the son learned at his father's knee. I may have indicated something along those lines to Bobby Ocean. I bet he took it under advisement. Fortunately for you, he's completely mistaken about your involvement in the immolation of the truck.
Moxie never conducted any conversation over a phone line that he wouldn't be unconcerned to hear played back to him in a court of law or in a police interview room.
He is, but I may have struggled to disabuse him of that notion.
Then let him live with it. Bobby Ocean's not a criminal. Any retribution he might seek would probably be through legal channels. He's a bigot, but he's not a fool.
Unlike his son.
Which begs the question, why wasn't Billy knocking on your door seeking restitution?
I don't think Billy's father has shared with him any misguided suspicions he might have.
Because if he did, Billy might retaliate with an act of gross stupidity.
Which could result in Billy ending up in jail or getting hurt, or worse.
And, said Moxie, the kind of person who'd blow up a truck due to its Confederate-themed decor probably wouldn't appreciate the owner getting in his face over it.
Parker considered all possible outcomes from a confrontation between Louie and Billy Ocean.
Actually, Parker replied, he probably would.
Chapter 39. Billy Ocean hated folks calling him by that name. He hadn't always hated it. To begin with, he'd enjoyed having a nickname, especially after seeing those movies with George Clooney as the con artist Danny Ocean. His pleasure had only increased when it was pointed out to him that the Ocean's movies were based on an older film, one in which Frank Sinatra played Danny Ocean. And you didn't get much cooler than Sinatra in his Rat Pack prime. The problem was that Billy's father had been given his nickname out of a kind of respect, even a little affection. He was Bobby Ocean, King of the Wharfs. He wasn't someone you wanted to cross, but he did his best not to screw over the working man. Not as long as the working man was white. Or if Bobby did screw him over, he made sure to hide his misdeeds behind a corporate entity that could be linked to him only by conjecture. It was natural, then, that his son should inherit the Ocean moniker, just as he was destined someday to become Prince of the Piers, the heir to the empire. Except it hadn't worked out that way, because his father didn't trust Billy enough to make him privy to the important decisions, the ones that related to multi-million-dollar building projects, the endeavors that were changing the character of the city, stamping it with the identity of a man who had started out cleaning fish guts from market floors. Bobby Ocean had encouraged his son to learn about the family's various business interests from the bottom up, to earn the respect of the men who would ultimately contribute to his wealth by laboring alongside them. But Billy didn't have time for that kind of shit. Surely that was why his old man had slaved his ass off to begin with, so his son could ascend from a more elevated position, raising his father's legacy to greater heights because he wasn't mired in scales and fish heads. But his father didn't see it that way. His father looked at Billy and could barely conceal his disappointment. Billy resembled a bargain basement version of his old man, soft where the sire was muscular, dull-eyed where he was watchful, and conniving where he was clever. Billy was dumb and self-centered, but he wasn't so dumb and self-centered as to be unable to perceive his father's true feelings. It was just that he couldn't comprehend the reason for them. So instead of sitting in on meetings with developers or managing a couple of bars and fancy restaurants with a sideline and chasing tail, Billy was scrabbling in the dirt. He knew folks around town laughed at him behind his back, and sometimes, if they'd had enough to drink, right in his face. Although they always pretended after that it was all in good fun.
"We didn't mean anything by it," they'd say. "We were just joshing with you. You're a good guy, Billy."
An arm would be thrown over his shoulders. Someone would sing a semi-mocking chorus of "When the going gets tough, the tough get going." This was another thorn in Billy's side. He listened to a lot of rap music, because one thing the Negroes did well was rap, although maybe not as well as Eminem, who was the best as far as Billy was concerned, and blacker than black. But Billy didn't like having a nickname associated with a Negro,
It wasn't right.
So the call would go up for another round of drinks, and Billy would smile and take it, because it was to this his father had reduced him. The butt of a joke. A punch for stronger men. And then to cap it all, someone had blown up his fucking truck. Billy loved that truck. It was everything he'd dreamed it would be. But he'd barely grown familiar with its ways before someone reduced it to a smoking shell. To make matters worse, Billy was supposed to be paying the insurance monthly. But what with one thing and another, including certain liquidity issues, he'd let the payments lapse. Man, was his father pissed when he heard that. Which left Billy looking for clues in the aftermath of the arson attack, only to receive shrugs in return. He knew there was no shortage of resentment toward him and his father. In a city as small as Portland, a man like Bobby Ocean couldn't rise to a position of power without leaving wreckage in his wake, and some of the resulting anger would inevitably be deflected in his son's direction. But blowing up a truck was a big step to take. Scratching it with a key, maybe, or slashing its tires. After all, Billy had done such deeds and worse to the vehicles of others. Destroying a thing of beauty like his truck, though. Well, that required a debased mind. But over the last couple of days, Billy had come to suspect his father knew more about what might have occurred than he was willing to share with his son. This inkling was the result of a conversation with Dean Harper, who had worked on the boats with his father back in the day. Now, thanks to Bobby's loyalty to those who were loyal to him, Harper served as his driver, messenger, and general man-at-arms. Dean wasn't considered bright, but he was a lot smarter than he pretended to be, and there wasn't much that went on along the waterfront to which he was not privy. Dean Harper's weakness was alcohol, although he was hardly unique around the piers in this respect. Yet Dean was more disciplined than most in his habits. Twice a month, starting on Friday night and ending early Sunday morning, Dean went on the kind of bender that would frighten demons back into hell, which had led to him being blacklisted by all of the city's better drinking establishments, and even some of the worse ones. Admittedly, Dean enjoyed a golden period for about 2 hours on the Friday evening, when he was still only knocking back beers and hadn't yet transformed into the hulking, brooding figure that had once, in the depths of a particularly bleak drunk, tried to ram a cruise liner with a lobster boat. It was during the most recent of these mellow patches that Dean let slip to Billy something about a shine being in the bar shortly before Billy's truck went the way of the Hindenburg, a reference Billy didn't get, but figured involved smoke and fire.
"I can't tell you nothing more, Billy," Dean had added. "You're old man."
Whereupon Dean's mood had suddenly darkened, and he'd wandered off to bust up a pool table, leaving Billy to pay the tab and think about what he'd just heard. A shine, the flags on his truck. It all started to make sense now. A Negro had taken offense at Billy's choice of decoration, and the end result was the immolation of Billy's pride and joy. Billy didn't know a whole lot about history, but he recalled that brave men had died for his right to freedom of expression, which Billy chose to interpret as the right to be as offensive as he chose, and those fine individuals were not going to have sacrificed themselves in vain. Billy didn't like to think of the coloreds as shines, or, much worse, niggers. His father didn't hold with that kind of language, and had passed this on to his son. Bobby Ocean took the view that only uncouth men used racially derogatory terms, so in public they were blacks, and otherwise Negroes. A man, said Bobby, could demean the Negroes all he liked, Latinos, Jews, and Arabs too, but had to learn to temper his language in both public and private. It was important to appear reasonable, to disguise prejudice with plausibility. Be moderate in your speech, his father would say, so you can be radical in your actions. Queers were different, though. As far as Bobby Ocean was concerned, you could call them what you liked.
Bobby Ocean fucking hated queers. So Billy had stoked himself with some Dutch courage and gone to confront his father with this newfound knowledge gleaned from Dean Harper. The response hadn't even been a denial on his father's part, just a quietly spoken instruction to get the fuck back to his own apartment and never again mention that fucking truck in his father's presence. Dean Harper was also given his walking papers, having crossed the line drawn in the aftermath of the cruiser lobster boat incident, which left Billy with even fewer friends in his father's circle than before. A Negro, Billy thought. A fucking Negro. Chapter 40. Mela Lombardi regained consciousness in her favorite armchair. It took her a while before she could manage to keep her eyes open, and her head throbbed with a nausea-inducing headache reminiscent of the worst migraine she'd ever suffered. She heard someone moan, and was briefly confused and irritated by the sound, until she realized that she was the one making it. A man was seated before her. He was reading from a small volume in his lap, and did not so much as glance up when Lombardi exhibited signs of wakefulness. She grasped the opportunity to examine him. His build, thin but not frail, his clothing, a mix of velvets and tweeds, finished off with a pair of sensible brown brogues. His face, handsome in a cold way, the eyes intelligent and curious, but entirely without warmth. A slim, elegant finger was raised over the page he was contemplating, as though he were silently taking issue with the author's words. Mela tried to recall how she'd ended up in the chair. She remembered being uncomfortable in her own space, and a bad smell or combination of smells, then nothing. She was compos mentis enough to realize she hadn't simply fallen or taken a turn, and therefore whoever was responsible for placing her in the armchair had not done so out of any great concern for her well-being. She tested her arms and legs. They had not been secured in any way. She could, she supposed, have tried to make a break for freedom, but she didn't imagine that she'd get very far in her current state, which probably explained the absence of restraints. That, and the fact she was a small woman in her 70s with a bum hip and a bad back, which limited her options, even under the best of circumstances. Which these, most assuredly, were not. The man spoke, still without tearing himself from his book.
"What are you thinking?"
he said. Mela tried to speak, but her mouth was too dry. Movement came from behind her, and a woman's hand extended a glass of water. Mela made an effort to turn her head, but even this slight exertion caused her nausea to increase exponentially, and it was all she could do not to puke on the floor. She grasped the glass with both hands. The water was mercifully cold, and had the effect of clearing some of the fog from her mind. Her eyes appraised more closely the face of the man in the chair. She decided she didn't care for him at all.
"I was thinking," she said, once she cleared her throat, "that some of the more educated Nazis probably resembled you. Not the hoodlums like Bormann or Rome, but those who fancied themselves sophisticates. Heydrich, perhaps, or Eichmann. Those who took pride in using the correct silverware."
The man smiled. It wasn't a false smile. He appeared genuinely amused.
"That's quite a statement from a woman at the mercy of strangers."
Mela finished her water and set the glass on the small circular table to her right, where she kept the clicker for the TV alongside a bag of sea salt caramels from Len Libby's.
"I don't believe you have any mercy in you at all," she said.
"Oh, you'd be surprised."
Only now did he give her his full attention, and Mela experienced a similar sensation to the one she sometimes felt in great art galleries, when she stared at a face in a painting by an old master and discerned the amplitude of centuries.
"Are you Jewish?"
he asked.
"I'm wondering about your earlier analogy."
"My father was a Jew," said Mela. He married a Gentile, so according to the Torah, I'm not Jewish, and I couldn't be even if I wished it.
And do you wish it?
No.
Why not?
My father was the only member of his family to survive the camps. He and my mother left Italy just in time to avoid being rounded up.
The rest must have been unlucky. My understanding is that a great many Italian Jews survived the Holocaust.
And more than 7,000 died, so a great many didn't.
Her interlocutor conceded the point with a regretful inclination of his head. That kind of history, he said, might cause some to embrace their heritage, not reject it.
We live in a despicable world. I don't see any reason to give repellent men an excuse to hate me further.
Why should they hate you at all?
In my experience, being a woman is usually enough.
The man stared past her to the unseen figure behind.
I suspect my colleague might concur with that position.
Was she the one who knocked me out?
She was.
Then you'll understand if I could give a fuck about her opinion. What did she use on me?
Chloroform.
It's nasty stuff.
But not terminal.
Does that come later?
It depends.
On what?
The outcome of our dialogue.
What's your name? I don't favor discourse amid anonymity.
You can call me Quail.
No first name?
Not any longer. My turn at a question. Is it true that you help women in distress?
I won't deny it.
Nor should you. It's a noble vocation.
You're a patronizing individual, but I believe it's endemic to your gender.
I'm looking for someone who might have passed your way. Her name is Caris Lamb.
Mela Lombardi did not respond, either by words or alteration in expression. Quail pressed her.
Is the name familiar to you?
I can't say that it is.
The slap to the right side of her head was so forceful and vicious that Mela felt something tear in her neck, and when she tried to straighten up, the pain made her cry out. She tasted bile in her mouth, and suddenly she was puking on herself and the carpet, and was ashamed, even though she had no cause to be. She began to cry, and she didn't want to cry, not in front of these people, not in front of anyone. She had spent her life trying to protect the vulnerable from the predatory. Women and children had found their way to safety through her. If the world were fair, then protection and safety would in turn have been offered to Mela in her time of need. But the world was not fair, because men ruled it. The woman went to the kitchen and returned with a damp towel, which she used to wipe Mela's face and clean some of the filth from her sweater and skirt.
"Do you know how I acquired this volume?"
Quail asked, once Mela had recovered a little of her composure. Mela squinted at the cover and caught the name and the title. Marcus Aurelius.
"I found it on Errol Dobie's shelves,"
Quail continued,
"just before my colleague punctured one of his eyes. Dobie then began speaking more freely, but he could just as easily have done so with both eyes intact. And because I was disappointed with him for making us resort to such savagery, we burned his book collection to ashes and consigned his body to the same flames. Finally, we paid a visit to his girlfriend, Esther Bachmeyer, and took her for a ride. She died more painfully than Dobie. And all because he couldn't answer a straight question. Am I making myself clear?"
"Yes."
"So, Caris Lamb."
"Caris Lamb is dead."
"How do you know?"
Mela spat a fragment of old food from her mouth.
"You ought to watch more TV."
Chapter 41. History echoes. History rhymes. Parker's grandfather, who spent most of his adult life in the uniform of a Maine state trooper, had witnessed the immediate aftermath of life's dissolution in many forms. Highway collisions, assaults leading to fatality, expirations in sleep, on the street, over dinner. hunting accidents, suicide, and murder. The old man gave long consideration to the actions of mortality, and the conclusion he reached was that the moment of a man's passing was not written at the time of his birth, and death possessed no stratagem. Death was a being of expediency. It had no need to deviate excessively from its path to find quarry. Humanity drifted in and out of striking distance, and if death missed its mark the first time, the dupe would eventually come around again, and death would barely have to exert itself to strike the terminal blow. Death was patient. Death was inexhaustible. But death also liked patterns. Death had its own cadence. And so it was that Jasper Allen, who had faced down Gillick and Audette as they raced for the Canadian border and welcomed a shard of masonry into his flesh for his troubles, Jasper Allen, who bore the name of his sire and grandsire and great-grandsire, back to a Jasper Allen who fought in the siege of Fort St. George in December 1723, when the Abenaki surrounded the Thomaston stockade on Christmas Day and kept it under continuous assault for 30 days thereafter. Only for that Jasper Allen, the first of his line, to lose his life a few months later, when the Abenaki trapped the whaling boats of Captain Winslow and Sergeant Harvey and butchered every white man they found. Jasper Allen, father, husband, who after the birth of three daughters had at last been gifted a son to whom he might pass on the eponym of his forebears. Jasper Allen, state trooper, heard death's meter, and danced unconsciously to it. Allen was barely 15 minutes from home when he pulled over a Honda Civic coupe that was tearing up the blacktop on the road to LaGrange. The two young men inside were Dale Putnam and Gary Newhouse, although this would not become known until much later, just as it would not be clear why events transpired as they did until all but one of those involved were dead. Putnam had an outstanding warrant for probation violation and theft by deception. This in itself would have been enough to land him back in the county jail had he and Newhouse not also been transporting 400 bundles of heroin in the trunk of the Honda, each bundle consisting of 10 bags. They'd managed to strike a good deal on the heroin down in New York, $30 per bundle or $12,000 for the batch, which in Maine could be sold for at least $15 per bag. So in return for their initial outlay, Putnam and Newhouse were guaranteed to turn a profit of $48,000, of which they'd have to kick back $18,000 to the guy who had fronted them the money, leaving them with $15,000 each to reinvest in heroin. This they fully intended to do, because Maine was just one big vein waiting to be fed. Newhouse personally knew three guys who were using 500 bags a week, 10 bags per shot. So what they did not need was for some Herman Munster motherfucker dressed in blue to pull them over because they were doing maybe 10 miles above the limit, especially with Putnam, who was behind the wheel, also coming down from a meth high, and thus on the verge of tweaking. All of which went some way toward explaining why, as he handed over his license, Putnam saw fit to pull a High Point C9 and shoot Jasper Allen through the underside of the jaw, killing him instantly. The two men then dumped the body in the bushes, and in an effort to sabotage the dashboard cam and the hard drive in the trunk, set fire to the cruiser before driving to the outskirts of Lincoln. There they hid the Honda in the garage of a run-down property that had been on the market for long enough to suggest it would never sell, and walked to a fast food restaurant from which they called for a ride from their money man, to whom they initially decided to say nothing about the killing of a state trooper. Putnam had been born on the same day as the late Ryan Gillick, and Newhouse came from the same town as Bertrand Audette. But again, these coincidences would only emerge over the days and weeks that followed. The immediate effect of Allen's death, other than to leave a woman widowed and four children without a father, was to cause the cancellation of the press conference called for the following day and the withdrawal of most of the MSP evidence team from the dig site. And death, insatiable, marched on. Chapter 42. Quayle moved his chair closer to Mela Lombardi, so near that they might have spoken in whispers and still have been intelligible to each other. As with Errol Dobie, it lent the discourse a strange intimacy, one destined to be reinforced by the act with which it must inevitably conclude, the penetration to come, the yielding of the flesh to fatal invasion, that for now remained unacknowledged by both parties.
"You appear very certain it's Karras they've found," said Quayle.
"The timing is right," Mela replied. "And how many mothers of newborns do you think are buried out in those woods?"
"I couldn't possibly say. But you might be lying."
"Why would I do that?"
"To protect her."
"I think she was already long past protection by the time she came to me. She'd given up hope for herself. It was the baby she wanted to save."
"She told you this?"
"She didn't have to."
Quayle looked to the woman with him. Mela caught a hint of some private exchange, a silent understanding, and realized that her interpretation of the situation was flawed. This wasn't just about Karras or the baby. But if not, then what else could it be?
"So Dobie and Bachmeier sent her to you?"
"By way of another staging post."
"Did they inform you she was coming?"
"Esther said she might be."
"What did they share with you of her predicament?"
"Nothing, except that Karras was in trouble and was certain someone would be coming after her. Someone bad."
"The father of the child?"
"That's what Esther assumed. Are you the father of the child?"
"No, I am not."
"But here you are. Therefore Esther's assumption was wrong."
Quayle shook a finger at her in what might have been mistaken for good-natured warning.
"I fear you're playing semantic games with me. Perhaps you'd like Pallida to strike you again. Or, in common with the late Errol Dobie, you're curious to find out what the world looks like when seen through one eye."
Mela took a deep breath.
"I want neither."
"Then give me straight answers. What did Karras tell you?"
"She told me that the father of the baby was an occultist and an abuser of women and children. She said that what she'd taken from him would destroy him. Those were her exact words. She didn't elaborate, and I didn't press her on it."
"Why?"
"Because that wasn't my role. I was her guardian, however briefly, not her interrogator."
"You can't have guarded her very well if she ended up in a shallow grave."
Mela winced. The barb stuck, but it didn't take her long to shake off its sting. When she had done so, her gaze seemed keener than before, and she looked on Quayle more in disappointment than disgust, as once she might have regarded a schoolchild who used an inappropriate word in her presence.
"That was unworthy, even of you," she said.
"You don't know me well enough to make that judgment. Yet I concede you may be right. I withdraw the remark. In return, you might try to explain how a young woman who came to you for help now lies in a morgue after many years in the ground."
"She wouldn't stay," said Mela.
Her voice trembled, but on this occasion she was not ashamed to show emotion. It was no sign of weakness. She was right to feel sorrow for Karras and her lost child, and with this came guilt at her own failings. Mela had been unable to persuade Karras to remain with her. 2 nights was as long as Karras would allow herself to rest. That was how scared she was of those who might come after her. Now, gazing upon this interloper in her home, Mela appreciated that Karras had been wise to be scared. Because Mela decided that Quayle, either by nature or inclination, was not quite human.
"But you must have passed her along to someone else, just as Dobie and Bachmeier entrusted her to you."
"I gave her some names," Mela admitted. She wiped away a tear. "She was planning to go to Canada, and I had contacts in Quebec and New Brunswick."
"But not elsewhere in Maine?"
"No, she didn't want to tarry here."
Quayle took all this in, then turned to Moores.
"Well?"
"I think we should blind her," said Moores.
I think so, too.
No!
The word emerged as a scream from Mela's throat, more like the cry of a bird than any mortal sound.
Please, I'm telling you the truth. I drove her to the bus station and she bought tickets for 3 different destinations, Bangor, Montreal, and Fredericton, New Brunswick. Then she asked me to leave, so I wouldn't know which route she'd taken.
Didn't she trust you to keep her secrets?
Not if faced with someone like you.
Quayle sat back in the chair. The volume of Marcus Aurelius had remained in his left hand throughout, and now he stroked it with the fingers of his right, like a kitten curled.
"You are a formidable woman, Miss Lombardi," he said. "I really do admire you a great deal."
"But not enough to let me live," said Mela.
She could no longer tell if she was crying for Caris or herself, for both or for all, for every frightened, bruised, and tortured woman or girl who had ever come to her seeking help and consolation. And who would take her place after she was gone? There would always be too few people in this world who cared enough to put themselves at risk for the sake of strangers, and too many who sought to inflict pain on the familiar and nameless alike.
"No," said Quayle, "not enough for that."
"Then damn you both to hell."
"I'm sorry," said Quayle, even as Mors drifted from her perch to circle and descend. "But I promise it won't hurt." And it did not.
Chapter 43. Parker attended the funeral of Jasper Allen. The little Methodist chapel was so full that the mourners spilled out into the spring sunshine, and the service was broadcast to the assembly via a hurriedly arranged system of loudspeakers. Representatives from police departments in New England and beyond came to pay tribute, so Parker knew a lot of the faces. He spoke with one or two of those in attendance, including Gordon Walsh, but otherwise kept his distance. He had nothing to offer. He had met Allen only once and liked him. That was all there was to it. The service was simple. Some hymns, a sermon, and a eulogy from the colonel of the Maine State Police, who had known Allen personally. They had both grown up in Millinocket, only a year apart in age. Fatalities among Maine State troopers while on duty were rare. Parker thought they might amount to double figures, but just barely. And of those, Allen was only the 3rd or 4th to be killed by gunfire. Lawmen never became inured to the deaths of their own, even in the most violent of cities. But the shock was always greater in a state like Maine, which ranked among the lowest in the Union for rates of violent crime, generally slugging it out with Vermont for the honor. Parker listened to the colonel's words and watched a blackbird picking at a patch of damp soil in the shadow of the chapel. It was the first blackbird he'd seen that year. Typically, they didn't return to the state until later in March, closely followed by turkey vultures, then the robins and sparrows in early April. To know birds was to know seasons, another aspect of life here that Parker had learned from his grandfather. The long winter silence of the woods, fields, and marshes were being broken by avian song at last. The service ended. Parker did not linger, nor did he head to the cemetery. He didn't want to see Allen's weeping wife again, or stare upon his shocked children. He'd witnessed grief too often to wish to carry the burden of it without necessity, or indulge in any voyeuristic partaking in the misery of others. The car used by Allen's killers had been found burned out the night before. Parker gleaned from Walsh that a witness, a woman named Letty Wellette, had come forward to claim her boyfriend had picked up 2 men on the evening of the shooting, not far from where the car was discovered, and brought them home. Both of the new arrivals appeared nervous, and she overheard a subsequent conversation about a gun, although she didn't pick up any further details because she was exiled upstairs to watch TV and mind her own business. The boyfriend, who went by the extravagant name of Hebron Caldicott, Heb to his associates, made a living buying and selling used vehicles, and Ouellette thought the make and model of the burned-out car sounded similar to one that had, until recently, been taking up space in the lot adjoining their property. She had also indicated, albeit reluctantly, that Hebb called